Good evening, family. My name is Steve, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
By the grace of God, this fellowship and the 12 steps, I haven't had to take a drink since February 6th of 2012. You introduced me as being from Charlottesville. That's not necessarily true anymore. I'm actually hailing from Lynchburg these days. Although I did get sober in Charlottesville, and that's actually where my home group is. My home group is the Common Solution. We meet at 7:30 on Thursday nights at the church on Hinton Avenue. I've seen a lot of you guys there, so I know most of you. Come on down anytime. Even though I live in Lynchburg, that's still my home group. I don't know if I'll change home groups ever. I have a home group. I've got a job in that home group, and I'm active in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Active participation in this fellowship is the only thing that's been able to get me sober and keep me sober and somewhat comfortable in my own skin. Tonight, Sam, I'd like to thank you for asking me to come and speak here tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to do anything for this fellowship, which has done so much for me. You know, for a person who didn't think that they would live to be 18 years old, and then didn't think to be they'd live to be 21 years old, and then didn't think they'd live to be 30, and to be 41 years old today and sober and standing in front of you guys, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous surely does work miracles. So my mother and father were high school sweethearts. They met in a small town. They grew up together in a small town called Athens, West Virginia. That's very close to Princeton and Beckley and Bluefield, and that's also where I grew up. My father was in the Navy, and he got sick when I was very young, and he died when I was 3. So I have no real memory of my father. My mother remarried, and the man that she chose had 3 sons of his own, and this was my new step family. I had a resentment probably from as far back as I can remember, because one of my earliest memories was taking the Sears catalog to my mother, you know, and asking her if we could buy a new daddy. You know, because I'd see the pictures of the guys in there. They were actually selling suits, but you know, these guys looked like eligible fathers. they look, you know, and so you know, from a very early age, you know, I wondered, you know, about God and why God would take my father from me, and you know, and maybe this was my fault. So you know, now I have this new father in my life, and his children. And, you know, these guys were completely different than something that I was used to. And it wasn't a loving environment. There was a great deal of abuse that went on. And so I learned at an early age to accept and use the mantle of victim. And even though, you know, I got over a lot of the things that went on in my youth later on, I still wanted to use that victimization to justify my alcoholism. So I took my first drink at a very early age. I was 8 years old. My mother and my stepfather would often leave me and my younger brother alone with my stepbrothers so that they could go and have fun with their friends and things like that. And my older stepbrothers, of course, were teenagers, and they were throwing wild parties while my mother and father were gone, and they would have me to clean up the mess. And one of my stepbrother's friends, I'm standing there washing the dishes. I'll never forget this, of course. I'm standing there washing dishes, and one of my stepbrother's friends came and brought a bottle of Black Velvet and said, here, take a drink of this. And I took a pull off of it, and I felt warm all over, and I was like, wow, there's something different going on. And obviously, these guys are having a really, really good time. You know, I can tell that everybody was having a good time. Now, I didn't get drunk, but I could tell that there was something powerful about this substance in this bottle. So, you know, the years went on, you know, and by the time I was like 10, 11 years old, my stepbrothers learned that they could sell me shots of beer. Little shots of beer for $1.50. And I wanted to be one of the guys. I wanted to drink. This is what it meant to have fun and be a man. You know, and I would probably get a half a beer or a beer out of it. they go by a whole case. You know, I had no idea what was going on. But, you know, around this time, this was this one side of my family. So on the other side of my family, my father's side of the family, I had a whole group of first cousins. And so once a month, I got to go and spend the weekend with them and my grandmother on that side. So all my first cousins were experimenting with alcohol, and they got drunk on a lot of other things besides alcohol. And, you know, they were having fun with me. And, you know, by the time I was 11 or 12, you know, I was drinking with them, but I hadn't really gotten drunk. Well, I still remember when I was 13 years old, I was out with my cousin. His name is Lorne. And we had a bottle of Canadian Mist. And, you know, we were making mixed drinks in a McDonald's cup with a straw. And drinking mixed drinks. And the next thing I know, I had arrived. It was on. Now, there's something I really need to explain to get to this point is that I always felt different because, you know, I wasn't one of my stepfather's sons. And he didn't treat me like I was. He didn't. He said that he was going, you know, over the years that, you know, I raised you like you was one of my own. But he didn't really. So I felt different already there. In school, I felt different. I didn't belong and I'd do anything. I was the class clown. I was doing anything that I could do to fit in and belong. When I was around my cousins, I felt kind of like I belonged, but I still felt a little different. Well, that night with that Canadian Mist, I had arrived and I didn't feel different anymore. I felt comfortable in my own skin and I felt like this was something that I needed to do as regularly and as often as I could. So I did. around that time, over these years, I had learned the arts of thievery, manipulation, lying, and I started using those tools to make it to where I could get what I wanted, which was to get drunk as often as possible. By the time I was 15, my mom decided to leave my stepfather, and this started an incredible resentment for me because, you know, over the years of abuse, that hadn't been enough for my mother to leave. But then when she felt she had been wronged, now it was time to leave. Never once, you know, until after I had worked these steps did I put myself in her shoes and look at it in her perspective. But this was a resentment that I carried with me, you know, for years, even after she had passed. And it was only through working these steps that I was able to resolve that. We'll get into that in a minute. But she decided to leave. And at that point, I took control. I took the wheel. She had no control over me whatsoever. And I manipulated my way into letting her let me go and live with my grandmother, which was the house right next to the house where my first cousins lived. Okay, so there was five first cousins and me, so there were six of us, and we were all around the same age, and we all ran together, and we all did the same things together, and we were a pretty rough crowd, and at that time, I had absolutely no parental guidance whatsoever. It wasn't uncommon for me to just look at my grandmother and say, "Bye, I don't know when I'll be home," and I was 15. And I would leave, and I would go out, and I would stay with friends. A lot of my friends were older, in college, and even older than that. And the next thing you know, I'm drinking alcoholically. And I'm a daily drinker. And I'm a blackout drinker. And at that time, I adopted this decadent rock and roll lifestyle philosophy that I was going to live fast and die young, and I didn't really care. You know? I did a lot of crazy, terrible things. But something happened along the way, and I fell in love, and I decided that I wanted to live. You know how those crazy things happen. And I was going to better my life, but you know what? I might have to put the bottle aside if I was going to do that. And so that obviously means that I need to leave Princeton, West Virginia, because if I move somewhere else, I won't drink the way I'm drinking now. This is me at 18 years old. So I moved to Columbia, South Carolina. And of course, I got down there and I didn't stop drinking. And all the years, my teenage years, when I was out there doing some crazy stuff, I didn't get in much legal problems at all. Nothing really major. As soon as I got to Columbia, South Carolina, they had my ticket. They had my number, and they knew what was up. Okay? So for like the next 8 years in Columbia, South Carolina, I had legal problems from the first week I was there, actually. you know, those things wouldn't make me stop. But, you know, I got some roommates down there in Columbia, and I'm having a really good time. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to stop drinking. I knew that before I moved. And so there was this one weekend in which everybody trusted me, and they gave me the rent money, they gave me the bill money, and I had all that money, and I was like, well, I know the bills need to be paid on Monday, but you know what? I think that we need to have a keg party. And so I threw this huge keg party and invited everybody. We had this wild party. When it was all done, said and done, I had like $2 left in my pocket, and I had to tell all my friends that, yeah, you remember all the good times we had like a couple of nights ago and all that? I don't have the rent money. And, the, you know, needless to say, they were very disappointed in me. And so, you know, I got my first real big shot of shame and guilt. And you know what? My alcoholism puts me in a state of extremism. That is, it's either really, really, really good or it's really, really, really bad. And so when it was really, really, really bad, my solution was, well, I guess I'm just going to kill myself. Over $325. Okay. So that didn't work out, but I did end up landing in my first AA meeting. I was 20 years old, and this was in 1992. So I'm there in my first AA meeting, and you guys told me some pretty simple things. You told me that I needed to get a sponsor, and that I needed to get a home group, and that I needed to, you know, I saw these steps and these traditions, and, you know, I was like, I saw that word God, and, you know, and I kind of started feeling iffy. And, you know, I left that night, and I drank that night. But I remember distinctly the people that were there and the friendliness and the atmosphere, and that was a memory that didn't leave me very quickly, but I still thought you people were crazy. And, you know, obviously I just needed a little bit more money, like probably about $325. You know, that would have fixed things really quick. You know, so, you know, I couldn't go back there, so I moved in with my mom. Briefly, she was actually living in Columbia, South Carolina. That's why I moved down there. And, you know, it didn't take long for my drinking to get out of control there, living with my mother, because she had no control over me whatsoever. And I ended up in treatment for the first time because they noticed, you know, my family members noticed that, you know, you're drinking too much. I remember bandying about the word alcoholic, even though I didn't know what that word meant. Until you guys explained it to me. I didn't know what that meant. I thought it meant the guy that drank too much and maybe might need to calm it down. I didn't realize, you know, what the true nature of this disease was. And my mother was in full denial. She was like, no. You are obviously not an alcoholic. You just need to go somewhere and get some treatment for a few days and you'll be okay. And so I did that and I was reintroduced to AA there again. And once again, I was just like, well, I don't think anything like this is going to work for me. I'm obviously in control. So my family rushed to my rescue, and they came up with the solution. The solution to my problem was is that I needed to go back to college. I needed to go to college, and I needed to get a career and that kind of stuff. And that would be the solution to my problems. So they fixed everything. They got me a car. They got me some money, and they got me into school, and I started going to school. And the next thing you know, I'm back to drinking again the way that I drank. And I did fairly well for as long as I could hold it together for a few years. Then I got a job at a bar. And I thought that was really going to work out pretty good for me. But, you know, this was the episode with my friends for the first time. That was the first time that I'd ever lost everything because I left all my stuff there and I couldn't go back to get it. And so I had to start over brand new. It wasn't a whole lot of stuff, but it was still my stuff and I left it. So I got the job at the bar, and during that year, I got my first DUI. That DUI, it was in May of 1997. I could actually see my house. And I told the cops, I said, that's where I live. And he said, you're under arrest for driving under him. You know, I was coherent. I wasn't rude or belligerent. They took me to jail. They knew me fairly well by then in Columbia, South Carolina. But I had public intoxications and simple possessions of marijuana and things like that. But I hadn't gotten a DUI. So I got this DUI and I got out on my own personal recognizance, and my family came and rescued me and brought me home. And about 2 weeks later, they took my driver's license away from me that night. About 2 weeks later, I got my driver's license back in the mail. And I said, wow, that means that I can drive. And for me, to drive means to drink and drive. I always drank and drove. So that was, my DUI was in May. In October of that same year, I got my second DUI. I don't remember that one happening. The story goes was that, what my last memory was taking a straight shot of Jack Daniels at an open bar, because I worked at a bar, so I got bar courtesy, at about 8 o'clock at night. My friends told me that they got me a ride home around 10 o'clock that night and left my car at the bar. Somehow in between 10 o'clock and 3:30 of that morning where the police arrested me, I had found my way 17 miles back to the bar and then 17 miles back to with 1 mile of where I lived at the time. And I didn't just get a DUI. I got resisting arrest, assaulting an officer, fleeing the scene. Like I said, my last memory was taking that straight shot. My next memory was being handcuffed on the side of the road, being sprayed down with mace. They took me to jail and washed me up, and obviously they have a problem with people who want to swing at officers and run away from them. So they didn't didn't charge me with anything for 72 hours. They put me in a holding cell with a Bible. And the lights never went off for 3 days. And I sat in there and I had one of those long nights of the soul where, man, I've just got to stop drinking. This is killing me. This is killing me. This is killing me. And, they didn't release me on my own personal recognizance, and I ended up spending 31 days in jail. And I lost the job at the bar. I had a second job that I also lost. I got 5 withdrawal Fs in college. My roommates at the time sold and kept all the rest of my belongings, except for my big book that I had bought before. They gave that along with a stack of bills to my mother. Okay, so I called my mom, whenever I got out of jail, and she had gotten onto this tough love thing. And and she said, you can spend the night here, but then you've got to go. And so, I get there and, I've got that stack of bills on that big book and, and the clothes that I'm wearing. And I stayed the night there and, I looked through those stack of bills. That's trash bills. I ain't never going to pay. And then there was one there that said, sometimes the unexpected just happens. And I opened it up and it was a live check for $1,000. My problems were solved. All this stuff that I'd been thinking, about staying sober when I was in jail, and all that was gone. And, all my friends that had completely and totally abandoned me, I called them up with a quickness and said, you need to come and get me, and we need to run to the bank right now. I did that. And, I tried to hold things together for another year in Columbia, South Carolina, but it just could not work because unlike, other people, I could not manage and control my drinking. When I got to these rooms, you guys explained it to me. Whenever I tried to control my drinking, I couldn't enjoy it. When I enjoyed my drinking, it was out of control. And you know what? I was not going to let you tell me how I could or could not drink. Most of my friends could not understand why, on Monday morning they woke up and went to work, and on Monday morning I woke up and took a shot, and said, hey, the party is never over. The party's never over. So, 1998, I ended up having to take a forced geographical cure because the city of Columbia, South Carolina, no longer wanted me. All this time I was a self-proclaimed atheist, and later on when I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I was able to look back and see how God had been working in my life all those years and had saved me from so many calamities. So, I end up back up there with surrounded by my first cousins who, they're in the downward spiral with me. And, in the years that I've been gone to Columbia, two of those original six had died as a result of this disease. One at the age of 18 was murdered over drug money. One at the age of 26 was also murdered because he liked to go out drinking with married women. And they had both died under the influence. And of course, my family didn't see that as a red flag or anything. That was, just like anything else, good day, bad day, it was time to party. Because, we were all alcoholic and that's what we do. So, I get back home there and I'm seeing the end, and I realize now today that I was pretty close to that jumping off point that we talk about in this book and in our literature. But I wasn't quite there yet because you know what? I'm in control of this thing. I'm in control of my life, and I'm going to make this thing work. Around that time, I got a call from a friend who invited me to come down to Charlotte, North Carolina to get a job. And I did that, and guess what? All my problems were solved and I was saved. It was all fixed because I had the good job. Now, I'd been to AA back and forth over these years, and every time I came in here, it was because something bad was going on in my life. And then just as soon as something good happened, I'd say, you know what? Maybe I overestimated this situation. You guys are crazy. I'm not an alcoholic. I am not one of you guys. I haven't lost all this stuff, and I haven't done this, this, and this. I can't be an alcoholic. I was in denial, So I get to Charlotte, North Carolina. I start working at this job. It ends up being this great job, and I'm making lots of money. Now, of course, I can't drive because I don't have a driver's license and I don't have a car. But it just so happened that, everything worked out perfectly to where I could walk to work. I found this nice little trailer park that was close to the liquor store. It was close to the laundromat. It was close to the food store. It was close to work and the bank. Man, I had it made. I was good to go. And so, this began a stage of my life in which I like to refer to myself as a functioning alcoholic. I work hard and I drink hard. I deserve to drink as hard as I do. And now, I literally had 9 lives at this job because I told them every lie in the book, and I had multiple family members who probably died more than once. And phone calls that I made, of trying to make excuses of how I couldn't make it into work. And, finally it started being, Steve, you're one of the best employees that we have when you're here. Those things. And, so I started thinking that there was something wrong with my life and I needed something else to fix me. Now, I was right. There was a hole inside me that I had been desperately trying to fill for years and years and years. And I'd tried to put the job in there and stuff and things like that. And you know what? Never once did it occur to me that I needed God, that I needed sobriety, and I needed you guys. But you know what I really needed? I needed a family. I need a family. That's going to fix me. And it just so happened that I started talking to a girl that I dated in high school, and she had 3 children. And the next thing you know, it was this summer-long romance. And, by then I had my driver's license again. So, the job had enabled me to do these things. And I wooed her, and I got her to move her and her family down to Charlotte, North Carolina, and I bought this big, beautiful house and, for us all to live in. And now that I have the family and I have the job and I've got the car and I've got the stuff, I've got all the things that I need, now I'm not going to drink, right? right? Wrong. Then I started this phase of trying to hide my alcoholism, of trying to be sneaky. You know, and of course I was trying to hide it from the rest of society, but now I'm trying to hide it from my wife, I'm trying to hide it from the kids, I'm trying to hide it from our friends, I'm trying to hide it from myself. You know, I'm basically just trying to hide. And I'm drinking inside of house and home. She has some other issues too that I want to blame everything on that, of course, you know. And once again, that allows me to be the victim because, you know, if you had a wife like this, you'd drink too. You know, if you had taken on the responsibility of three children that weren't yours, you'd drink too, wouldn't you? These were, you know, excuses. You know, and once again, every time the heat came on, I'd crawl in through these doors, and you guys would be here, and, you know, you'd say, well, Steve, what you need to do is get a sponsor, you need to get a home group, and you need to... You know, they'd always say, here, get you a big book. And I'd say, man, I got one of those. I've read that book. I've read that book. I know what that's all about. And, you know, every time I'd come in, you guys would tell me the things that I need to do. And every now and then I'd say, you know, maybe I could try to do some of those things, but not any of the rest of that stuff. No. I certainly don't need to pray, and I don't see how making coffee is going to get me sober. That's obviously not necessary, obviously. And so, things are falling apart for me at work. Things are falling apart for me at home. Things are falling apart. You know, finally there comes a day to where I know that she's going to leave and she's going to take the kids. They gave me a random drug test at work. This is one of my fondest, earliest memories of you guys. There was a guy named KC in Belmont, North Carolina. I was put on a suspension without pay from my great job. And, you know, and I've got this big mortgage and all this other stuff. And I'm thinking, man, I've got to get another job. I've got to do something. I've got to scramble. I need some money. But you know what, man? Maybe I should go to this meeting, this noon meeting, you know, because obviously I can't stop drinking. Something's up, you know. Very, very confused alcoholic. But I go to this meeting. I sit through the meeting. After the meeting, KC comes up to me and he's like, so, you know, tell me, Steve, what's going on? And I was like, man, I have got to go get a job because I need some money to pay my mortgage. And he said, well, what happened? I said, well, you know, they suspended me without pay. He's like, so you don't have to go to work? I said, no. He's like, great. That's great news. That means you can make more meetings. Come on, let's go to another meeting right now. I said, I don't think you understand. I got to get some money. I got to make some. He said, Steve, let me tell you this right now. And he looked at me in the eye, and I could just see that glow about him that I see so often now today because I surround myself with you guys. But he looked at me. He said, if you put this thing first in your life, all the rest of that stuff will take care of itself. I said, man, you are crazy. You are crazy. There just ain't no way it can take care of itself. I've got to take care of it. Don't you understand? I've got to take care of it. If I don't take care of it, it won't get done. So, you know, over the next couple of years, I saw KC often, and he was like, man, you know, you need to quit that job and come to a meeting. And that was in Belmont, North Carolina. I think that God's got a real funny sense of humor that I ended up getting sober in Belmont, Virginia. A couple years went by, and I got a sponsor finally. You know, after 16, 17 years of coming in and out of here, I finally got a sponsor, and his name was Bob. And Bob told me basically the same thing KC told me, but he told me that I needed to get out of that relationship, I needed to get out of that house, I needed to get away from them, and I needed to focus on recovery, and I needed to do it right now. And I asked him why, and he said, because, you know, if you don't put recovery first, anything you put before your recovery, you're going to lose. He said, and right now, you're putting that house before your recovery, you're putting that family before your recovery, you're putting all that stuff before your recovery. And he said, you need to get out, and you need some real work because, you know, you're an alcoholic. He's the first person who ever, you know, so many other people had eaten up all my excuses, you know, because if I went out and I drank again, there was always a good excuse. And I remember I went back in to pick up yet another white chip, and Bob was there. And afterwards, he looked at me with this grin on his face, and he said, so why'd you drink, Steve? He was setting me up, you know. And I said, oh, it was the wife, the mortgage. You know, you can fill in the blank. He looked at me. He said, no, Steve, you drank because you're an alcoholic. You drank because you wanted to get drunk more than you wanted to stay sober. He said, you don't have no more excuses now because you know where the solution's at. He said, the solution's in these rooms. You come back here and you hang out with us and you do what we ask you to do and you'll stay sober. He said, if you go out there and keep doing what you're doing, you're going to get drunk. And you know, I said, man, that's way too simple. No. It cannot be that simple. Obviously, there's something much more complex going on in these rooms than, you know, the AA equation that I have to solve, you know. And, you know, I say unfortunately, but it turns out that I don't regret the past, nor do I wish to shut the door on it. And so these things were necessary to happen in my life. But Bob was absolutely right. I didn't put recovery first, and I did lose the wife and the family. I did lose the house. I did lose the car and the jobs and the money and lost everything again. And this was the third time in my life. But, you know, at this time, they were going to foreclose my house. And I remember sitting in meetings and hearing people say, you know what, I was unemployed and unemployable, and I was great at identifying out, and I'd say, that's never going to happen to me. And then I realized that I couldn't hold a job down because I couldn't stop drinking for one day. And then, you know, there was the people who were saying, the wife, she took everything. And I said, yeah, that's never going to happen to me. And yeah, there it happened to me. And so I got a little bit closer to being one of y'all. You know, finally something happened. I can't really put my finger on it, but I think I showed up at a meeting drunk and somebody had some choice words to say to me, and I decided I was done with AA forever. I was never going to darken your doorstep again. I'm done. You guys can't fix me. Why haven't you fixed me in these last 20 years? Every time I come in here, you tell me all this crazy stuff to do. Why haven't you fixed me? So I left. And, you know, I called an old friend and went and tried to pick up the pieces. And once again, God, you know, said, hey, here's another chance for you. But it got me to Scottsville, Virginia. And, I got a great job. And that was going to fix everything. I was making the money. And then, you know, and I was hanging around with people who drank like I did. And they would accept, you know, the craziness and the insanity. They accepted it until I took it to the next level, to the level that I always take it to, until where they finally said, you know what? We might drink a bit, but you're an alcoholic, Steve. Finally, you know, I said, that's fine. You don't have to hang around me. You don't have to be around me. Nobody has to be around me. I'll sit in my room. You know, I'll sit in my room with my hot beer that I won't put in the refrigerator because I don't want to be around you no more. You know, I don't even want to walk past you. But finally, you know, I was back into that unemployable state, and this job had just about had enough of me. And in January of 2012, I began what I hope was my last binge of drinking. I remember I was on my way home, and I stopped and picked up a case of beer like I normally would. In Charlottesville, and then I drove down to Scottsville, and I lost a couple days here and there. I vaguely remember walking to the liquor store because I lived there in Scottsville. I could walk to the liquor store. I could walk to the beer store. And, you know, my next real memory was coming to Martha Jefferson, and I had a bunch of tubes sticking out of me, and I don't know how I got there. Now, I'd had plenty of blackouts before, but, you know, I'd always come to on the couch or on the floor or maybe on a parking lot or somewhere like that, but never, you know, in the hospital with tubes sticking out of me. And with, you know, the doctors finally came in, they were shining the lights in my eyes and asking me questions like, do you know what year it is? Do you know your name? You know, things like that. And really, I didn't have many quick answers. Now, I'd read this fine book enough to know. Now, while I was laying in that bed alone there for a minute, I remember thinking distinctly, this must be that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that you people have been talking about for years. This must be it. And I remember thinking that, And then I remember thinking, you know what, I got to get out of here because I need a drink. Mm-hmm. And I manipulated them, and I told them, hey, I'm fine. I'm fine. You just got to let me out of here. And I drank again. And 2 days later, I wound up in New Hope Detox on February 6th, 2012. And I went through a non-medical detox there, which was the closest thing to hell I've ever been through. They did an hourly monitoring of me to, you know, it was pretty bad. It was one of those half cup of coffee situations. But I remember clinging to the big book like grim death. And I remember it was down in Stanton, Virginia, and they, you know, I remember picking up my white chip and holding on to that like grim death too. And I remember thinking, you know, I have tried everything possible to not drink. Everything that is, except for the things that you guys told me to do. I'd never tried that. I'd tried to fight it in every way possible. I'd tried to deny it in every way possible. I'd asked God for proof that this thing worked after coming back year after year after year and seeing the same people sober and happy year after year after year. And every year I get more miserable and sick and stay drunk year after year after year. God was giving me the proof all along. So, you know, I tried to get into a couple of different treatment facilities, but as the powers would be would have it, I ended up in Charlottesville. And when I was in Charlottesville, I went to my first AA meeting there, and the first thing I thought when I sat down and they started passing around how it works was, they're doing it wrong. Because yeah, they're doing it wrong. Yeah. I'd never done it right. But I sat there, and I remember saying, you know, before I leave this meeting, I'm going to have a sponsor. I've got to have a sponsor, and I've got to start working the steps. Now, you know, they say that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. You know, and I think that God knew in my heart that this was the time that I was ready to just surrender and say, you know what, I'm ready to do it. And God put a member of the Common Solution in the chair next to me. And he looked over at me, and it was one of the most genuine, heartfelt smiles I'd ever seen. And he reached his hand out to me and said, hey, how are you? And I said, I'm doing great. And I asked that man to sponsor me. I was expecting one of these. Well, we'll start working these steps once you're sober for 90 days. That's what I was expecting. He said, are you ready to get to work today? Are you ready to get going right now? He said, he explained to me what he could do. He said, I'm going to take you through this book. And I'll work the steps with you, but that's all I can do. I'm not going to be a banker or a chauffeur or nothing like that. And I said, okay. What was amazing is we went through the first 164 pages of this book that I'd read 100 times, and it was like a brand new text to me. It's like I'd never even read it before. And things just came alive, and there were so many things that were pointed out to me. And, you know, so... And this was in the first couple weeks of me being sober, you know. So I got introduced to my home group, and I got a job in that home group. And, you know, while I was in treatment at the Moore Center, they said, you know, you've done a bunch of other crazy stuff. Maybe you should try something completely different, you know, because my friends down in Scottsville, you know, they were willing to let me move back down there. And the active alcoholism was going on. You know, they didn't drink as bad as I did, but they still drank. And I'm sure that if I got down there, it wouldn't take long for me to manipulate them, you know. And I ended up moving into a recovery house where I was surrounded by people in sobriety. It's Oxford House. I'm still there today. That's a different part of the story. But that's a completely different story, actually. I'm not going to really go into that. But while I'm there, you know, my job let me come back, and I'm working, I'm paying bills, and I got active in this fellowship. I got really active in this fellowship. I got 14 to 16 meetings a week active in this fellowship. I got out-of-town meetings as often and, you know, as I could active in this fellowship. And, you know... just like it says in the big book, a fellowship did spring up around me. There were guys that were just like me that were staying sober a day at a time, and they were working this program in their lives, and I could see it, and I wanted what they had. And they told me that if I wanted what they had, I had to do what they did. And so I did. And I'd stopped asking questions. I put the debate committee to bed completely, and they said, you need to wear a collared shirt to this meeting. I said, that's fine. I've got two or three of them. There's the ones I'll wear to this meeting. That's fine. You know, I worked the steps, and, I sat down and I did my fourth step. Now, there's something that we've got to go into. Thanks to you guys, before I even got sober, you guys had helped cure my atheism. Because in this book that I had read before, you know, there's the second step proposition, which we come to a point where we say either God is everything or God is nothing. What is our choice to be? And even when I was drunk, when I read that, there was just no denying the fork in the road situation, because I couldn't, in my heart of hearts, say that God was nothing. Even, you know, with the things that I believed. And so, you know, that seed of faith was already put in me before. And so when I finally did get sober in Charlottesville, I was ready to believe in a power greater than myself. And I was ready to take that leap of faith. And I was ready to trust the process and trust this program and do the things that were necessary. And so, you know, when I got to that third step, it was so good. You know, I wanted to struggle with it. I wanted to fight with that. And, you know, my sponsor said, no, wait a second. Hold on. Here's the deal. You've made a decision to stay in this fellowship, haven't you? I said, yeah. Well, yeah. And he said, good. Get out some pencil and paper and start writing down your fourth step. Let's go. Right now. And, you know, and that I wasn't used to that. You know, I was... And that's exactly what I needed. Because, you know, if I could have taken this thing on some kind of contemplative, philosophical journey, I would have, but I didn't need that. You know, for some reason, I kept overlooking the words action, you know, immediately. Things like that in the book. But thank God that I had surrounded, that God put me into the company of a group of guys who were like, you know, this is a program of action. I think that in that first month of sobriety too, somebody in my home group, and I don't think that he meant to do this on purpose, but it was a true God moment. I'm sitting out there in the audience and he's just speaking from the podium, and he looks out and he looks straight at me and he says, there's nothing to figure out in AA, only things that do. And I was like, oh man, yeah, what do you need me to do? So I started making coffee for my home group, and I started doing things for my home group. And you know, anytime, anywhere that anybody asked me to do something for AA, I said yes. And you know, something weird happened. Now I want to also throw this out there. In 27 years of active alcoholism, the longest piece of time that I was able to put together on my own, even coming into these rooms, was 78 days. And I remember it distinctly because, it wasn't until I got here that you guys told me the terminology had told me what untreated alcoholism was. But see, I knew what untreated alcoholism was because I had endured 78 days of it. And those 78 days, I had absolutely no solution. I was absolutely insane. And there wasn't a moment that I didn't think about taking a drink. And I was, you know, I had no solution. And you guys offered me a solution. You guys offered me a way out. And so, you know, I wrote my fourth step, and I did my fifth step, and, you know, and I did, I felt that nearness to my Creator, and I felt like I was a part of this fellowship for the first time. I wasn't just the guy who came late or left early or was just standing there. I actually felt like a part of this fellowship, and I knew that, you know, I could have had that 20 years ago. You guys had offered that to me 20 years ago, but I wasn't ready, obviously. And, you know, so I started working on, you know, I thought that I was going to get a kind of a segue out when I got to the sixth and seventh step because, you know, I looked at that and I said, wow, there was, you know, four or five chapters on those other steps, but there's only a paragraph and a prayer for the sixth and seventh step. Wow, that's going to be easy. Like, you know, thank God for great step study meetings and you know and my sponsor got me started on my eighth step list immediately, and so you know I started making amends to some of the people that I could. Now, you know, I wanted to go back to my ex-wife real quick and say, check this out. I've been sober for 4 months. What do you think of that? Thank God for good sponsorship. Because, you know, he said, have you ever thought that maybe they might be happier without you right now? Have you ever thought that it might not be all about you? Yeah. And I said, no. No, that thought really had never crossed my mind. So, you know, I started making the amends that I could, and you know, days were turning into weeks, were turning into months, and this was amazing. I couldn't believe that I was staying sober by doing the things that you'd asked me to do. How could it have been this simple for all these years? How could it have been this simple? And so, you know, I was praying every day. I was making up my bed, that kind of thing, you know, but I didn't know what or who I was praying to, but I believed and I trusted. And so the guys that I hang out with in my home group, we go out and do things together. We, you know, we go see concerts and we watch, you know, TV shows together. We do things together. We go to meetings together and that kind of stuff. And so there's this big heavy metal concert that I wanted to go to, and some of my home group guys wanted to, you know, go to, but in the end it turned out that they couldn't make it, and I had tickets and I was going to go. So I talked to my sponsor and he said, I think that you're okay. He said, let's go to a meeting first and you can drive up there. It was up in Bristow, Virginia. It was 2 hours away. And he said, you have your phone. If you get into an uncomfortable situation, just give me a call. I said, I'll do that. And so I drove up there and I was nervous. I was by myself, and, you know, now my traditional MO was not even to make it to the show. Okay, the way that I do it beforehand is that, you know, we had to start the pre-party about 3 days before the show even began so I could be ready for the show. And I wouldn't even make it to the show. Sometimes I'd be in jail. Sometimes I'd be passed out in the parking lot, you know, but very rarely could I make it to the show. Well, I made it to the show. I'm standing in line, you know, and this is a heavy metal concert. There's people with all kinds of crazy t-shirts on. And I'm just standing there, and I see this t-shirt, this guy, two guys up from me, and it says on the back, it says, where is your God now? And something happened. All the gears kind of clicked into place all at once. And I think that distance between here and here, something happened. And I remember thinking, well, my God is here with me right now. And if that's the case, I don't have to be afraid of anything, anyone, ever again, ever. And something happened. Okay, and I don't think it was a big spiritual white light experience, but it was enough to where I got out of line and I got out my phone and I called my sponsor and I said, hey, man, you know, I think something happened. And he said, did you drink? I said, no, 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 nothing like that, nothing like that. And I tried my best to explain to him, you know, and even right now, me explaining it like this, I can't really put words to it. He said, well, why don't you just go into the show and have a good time, and I'll talk to you tomorrow, you know. And I said, okay, man. So I went, and I went into the show. I had a good time, you know, and for the first time, I saw people, you know, they were drinking, and I had no desire for a drink. I feel to this day that was the day that the desire was lifted from me. And I remember seeing guys going to jail, and I was thinking, there, for the grace of God, go I, man. Whew. And then, I did the whole show, the whole day, and it was all day event. And then at the end of the night, I left, and I found my car in 2 minutes. <You know? laughs> And I got in that car, and I drove home. And I thanked God, you know, with the most earnest thanks in my, you know, for I am sober and I'm alive, and I just couldn't believe it. And I remember that I went to sleep that night, and the next morning I woke up. You know, I didn't pass out and I didn't come to the next morning. And it was just the most wonderful feeling. And it passed. But you know what? I kept on doing the work that you guys asked me to do, and I stayed active in AA. And, you know, it was about a month before my 1 year. And, you know, I had seen so many people pick up a year, it ain't funny. And my 20 years of coming in and out of AA, and I thought, that could never be me up at that podium. It'll never, I could never do that. And I got into a funk. It was real bad. And, you know, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and I talked to other alcoholics, trusted alcoholics about it. And I remember distinctly that I went to the Christmas Alcathon in Charlottesville, and I'm there with 150 alcoholics, and I felt absolutely alone. And I was like, you know, something ain't working here. This just isn't right. You know, and thank God that when I went home that night, I didn't go home alone. I went home, and I was surrounded by more alcoholics who said, there's something wrong with you, Steve. Talk to us. I did. And I talked to him, and then, you know, I got in deeper with my sponsor, and he said, you know what, I think you need to do. I think you need to go to more meetings. I think you need to put your hand out. You need to get more active. I said, how can I get more active in AA? I'm doing this, this, and this. He said, I'm telling you, it's going to work. And I said, okay, I got to have faith in the process, and I got to, okay, I'll do it. Okay. So I started going to more meetings. I started going to meetings that I hadn't normally gone to. I put my hand out every time, and, you know, and I still kept saying yes to AA, and things were getting worse, and it was just, I'd wake up and I'd feel miserable. I was all in my head, lots of self-pity. Then one day, after the holidays were over, sometime in mid-January, I remember waking up one morning, and I went to work, and somebody cracked a joke, and I smiled, and then I laughed, and then I had a big belly laugh, and I remember thinking, hey, I feel pretty good. Wait a second. That passed too. And then it dawned on me that I didn't have to take a drink. And that had passed. And I was like, okay, something's going on here. Maybe you guys have been right for more than half of my life. And I called my sponsor on that too. Now, you know, I have a different sponsor today, but it's the same deal. I'm still active in this fellowship. I still say yes to AA. I work in the recovery field, so I work with alcoholics on a daily basis, and, you know, it's the most rewarding thing in my life. And, you know, all those years Bob had told me, he's like, you know what, man, if you just put recovery first, if you put Alcoholics Anonymous first in your life, everything else will fall into place. And, you know, I always thought that he meant that it was going to fall into place the way that I wanted it to. Okay. And the fact of the matter is that God had different plans. But, you know, I've been told in this fellowship and by you people that what God has in store for me and what I have planned for me, God's always got something better down the road. So, you know, I put this program first in my life today. And in my life, everything started falling right into place. Not in the way that I had figured it out, but in ways that were so much better than I could have ever planned. You know, 3 years ago, if you'd have said, Steve, you're going to go back to AA. You're going to work those steps they've been talking about. You're going to be sober. I would have laughed. I would have laughed at you, and I would have laughed until I cried because I thought that this wasn't for me and it wasn't ever going to work for me. I was wrong. You know, today I have a relationship with the God of my understanding, and I have a relationship with you. I think I'm just about out of time. So, you know, part of the benefits of being a member of the Common Solution is that I get to borrow all kinds of speaker CDs and listen to speakers. And I drive a lot in my job, so I get to listen to a lot of different speakers. So I get to get the message in more ways than one. You know, God works that way. And there was a really good speaker that I've listened to in the last 2 or 3 months a couple of times, and he ends his talk with a little poem that's made the most sense for me in my recovery and in my life, and I would just like to share that with you. And he said, and the poem goes, I searched for my God I could not see. I searched for my soul eluded me. I searched for my fellow man, and I found all three. Thanks for letting me share. Yeah.